Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, the author of Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Isle Press is our guest this hour. And the book is really moving. It's a book about nonconformists, about the mystery of what impels people to do something risky when they are thrust into a morally compromising situation. And it looks at four different situations. A Swiss police officer who helped German Jews cross the border, a whistleblower in the financial industry, a U.S. military official resigning over conditions at Gitmo, and more situations. And our guest has had work appearing in the New York Review of Books, the New York Times Magazine, The Nation. He's also the author of Absolute Convictions. And he says we have much more of a literature on conformity, evil, and the various ways in which human beings fail to exhibit moral courage than we do the opposite. A lot of books that do go to the other side of the story are either sentimental or very trapped in a kind of hero's narrative. I tried to avoid that. I don't think the people I wrote about do heroic things. They certainly do. I wanted to get close to them and show the multidimensionality of them as characters. Isle Press, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really enjoyed the stories. And what's remarkable, it's so remarkable that you met many of these people or you interviewed descendants of these people years after their acts of heroism. And so let's start with the story where that figures so prominently, and that's the Swiss police officer. How do you pronounce his name?
His name was Paul Gruninger.
Gruninger.
And, Gruninger, yes. And he is the only character in the book, actually, who's not alive. But as you mentioned, I did go to the region in Switzerland where he did this transgressive thing and found his daughter and other relatives and also people who were the beneficiaries of his act. Can I say a little more about what he did?
Tell us his story. It's quite something.
Yeah, well, in 1938, Gruninger was the commander of the state police in the canton of St. Gallen, which shares a lengthy border with Austria. And a few months after Nazi Germany annexed Austria, the Swiss government passed a law saying calling on officers like Gruninger not to allow Jewish refugees into the country. Now, this was just as Jews in Austria were being terrorized and persecuted. Of course, Kristallnacht took place in 1938, that year. Well, the officers were told, enforce this new law without exceptions. And as I recount in the book, Gruninger made a lot of exceptions. He arranged for people to be hidden in the families of Swiss households. He falsified documents. He wrote letters and sent entry permits to the relatives of refugees who came to him begging for, saying, look, my mother or my brother or my sister is trapped in Austria and I fear I'll never see them again. He did this until he was caught. And we don't know the exact number of people he saved. Some say several hundred, others say several thousand. What we do know is that this man who thought he was upholding a Swiss tradition that went above the law, that is the tradition of Switzerland being a refuge for the persecuted, and who thought that because of that his act would be pardoned or understood, instead was stripped of his uniform, dismissed, and actually died in penury and disgrace. He was not officially acknowledged for the heroism of his act until 1993, 22 years after he died, and 45 years after he violated this law that many Swiss citizens today, of course, look back on with shame.
Right. You say that he spent something like 30 years after that looking for employment, 30 years looking for a job.
Yeah, and I think that in beyond the material hardship there is the sort of psychological feeling, and this is true of all the characters in the book, and I think it's what makes the type of courage I wrote about both so rare and remarkable, that it is not, we have forms of courage, physical courage, storming a mountain or fighting in a battle, that are widely lauded. We salute this kind of physical courage in a way that affirms what the person does. In these cases of moral courage, where people went against their own government, went against popular opinion, went against their community to do what was right, very few people approved. And indeed, that is part of what makes these people nonconformists, although they are, in a sense, nonconformists in spite of themselves.
Mm-hmm. You write that 25,000 Jews were denied entry into Switzerland. Under what auspices? Why weren't they allowed? We think of Switzerland as this beautiful place and the mountains, very accepting, very neutral.
Yes. They weren't allowed for the same reason that most countries in the world didn't allow them in. There was a fear of that they would take jobs away from Swiss citizens. This was in the 30s. The economy was not good in Switzerland and throughout the world. There was also, frankly, a lot of anti-Semitism and talk of Jewification. And one of the themes of the book is that to the extent that people are given orders to do cruel things to people they don't quite imagine as people, that is, they imagine them as Jews who don't belong in Switzerland, or to take a contemporary example, if you think of in this country during the civil rights struggle, if you imagine people as part of an inferior race, well, it becomes a lot easier to mistreat them, to do evil, and to conform to things that violate normal moral principles. Gruninger was this very seemingly ordinary guy. Nothing about him hinted at the idea that he would break the law. But one of the things that comes out and is striking that I discovered about him is that we have no record, no trace of him ever having said anything anti-Semitic, written anything anti-Semitic. And when he talked about the refugees, he simply described them as people. Mm. To us, that doesn't seem strange. Of course, they were people. But you have to go back in time and think about the fact that most people didn't do that. And one of the reasons Gruninger, I think, saw them as people is that he met them. He was right there on the border, and he heard their pleas. He saw their suffering, and that definitely affected him.
And you, the other remarkable part of the story is that you start the book with November of 1938, Kristallnacht, and a 14-year-old boy who's trying to cross the border and has to do it twice. And Gruninger finally lets him in, and you meet him later on in life, too.
That's right. Really, one of the most moving interviews I think I've ever conducted. I sat in a cafe with a very spry and lively man in his mid-80s, who, as you say, was 14 years old when he tried to sneak across this border. He actually took the little money he had, along with a few other fellows, and gave it to someone he thought would help him. It didn't work. They were sent right back to Austria, and then he tried again. And somehow wound up in an office of a refugee organization, and then this officer walks in, and of course Eric Billig is the name of this young boy. He's petrified. He's thinking, okay, I'm going to be sent back again, of course. And instead, Gruninger listens to his story and says, okay, you can stay.
But he has a chance. Gruninger's story is in the newspapers, and Eric has a chance at some point to make contact with him, and chooses not to do so. Why?
That was a very painful thing for Eric Billig to recount. His whole life changes at this moment on account of this extraordinary act by Paul Gruninger. And like a lot of the other refugees, he thought, well, maybe I should go and personally thank this guy, because I know he's still alive. I know Eric Billig remained in Switzerland. He went on to get married and have children and raise a family there. He told me, however, that he felt bad, and he felt bad because he knew that Gruninger's life had turned out so badly. I mean, it was no secret that, and as I say in the book, the Swiss officials went to extraordinary lengths to blacken Gruninger's reputation long after he'd done this. And I think the reason for that, there were rumors that what he did for sexual favors, that he demanded money from the refugees, even that he had secret ties with the Gestapo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these false rumors were only exposed as false in the early 90s, and one of the reasons I think they lingered for so long is that and this is a question I raise in the chapter: if Gruninger really didn't do this for any other reason than the fact that he felt human beings' lives were at stake and his own country's proud heritage as a refuge was at stake, what does that say about everyone else who did enforce the law?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you met his daughter, and she was in her upper 80s as well. Did she express any anger about the fact that nobody ever gave her father an apology?
She did not, which is quite remarkable. I'm not sure as I say in the book, there was a part of me that thought, well, maybe there's this family trait of just being able to forgive. Apparently, her father remained a very devout Swiss patriot throughout his life. But his daughter did not express bitterness, though I wondered when I met her what it would have been like if, say, we'd met in the 1980s before her father was rehabilitated and acknowledged, because there was a public campaign to do so, and it took effort after effort after effort. It was denied over and over again. Finally, they broke through. And one of the reasons they broke through is that some of the refugees, including Eric Billig, the guy I met, actually made a trip to St. Gallen and met with some of the officials, and there they had the human evidence in front of them of what Gruninger had done, and at that point it became, it really tilted the balance.
A lot of what you say runs throughout the book is that our tendency is to put someone like this Swiss police captain, Gruninger, on a pedestal, and to call them a saint, and yet if we do that, we let ourselves off the hook, because really, you ask, who's a saint? People in the book are in some ways strikingly ordinary.
Yeah, I really do feel that, and that is not because in any way I want to slight the acts that I describe. The acts are remarkable and admirable, but I think that when we too often in our public discourse, when we talk about, say, the righteous, the Gentiles who helped Jews during World War II, or other people who did moral things, we speak of them less as people than as sort of models of compassion or sainthood. And the problem with that is that, in a sense, I believe, if we put them on this pedestal, we relieve ourselves of ever having to emulate their example. I mean, who among us, after all, is perfect? Nobody. And who among us can really be, you know, a Gandhi or a Mandela or a Martin Luther King? What I hope is both a source of inspiration to people who read the book, but also a source of challenge, is to contemplate the fact that these people are not perfect, that they did have flaws, that and Gruninger as well. Not every story I tell in the book reflects well on him, and that's the reality, which I think is a more accurate picture and a more challenging one.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go next, after we pause a moment, for a Jew who helped Palestinians, another unlikely story considering this young man's background, and there are other stories as well. He also includes experiments. We need to talk about those, because the question is always asked, how in the world could people take actions that they have against their neighbors, the experiments that have shown what the combination of circumstances have to be in order for us to commit cruel acts, even though we don't think of ourselves as those kinds of people. Here's our phone number. We'd love to hear from you as well. Our number is 800-486-8255. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Ile Press is our guest, author of Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let's welcome in the audience for a moment before we hear the story of Avner Wishnitzer, starting with Chris in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Just before I went into the Marines, my father, who wasn't much for talking about personal things, sat down with me. And one of the things he told me that I've never forgotten is that he said, sometimes it's going to seem like it's very, very hard to know what the right choice is. He said, often that it's actually very easy to know what the right choice is, but it's a very hard choice. I think that's self-explanatory. Not too long ago, I read the book Man in the Gray Flannel Suit by Sloan Wilson, and one of the things he was talking about, it was about a war veteran entering the business world who begins to notice that acts of heroism that were actually fairly common in the war are very rare in the business world. In other words, saying no to your boss was extremely difficult, even when there's a knowledge in the back of your head that you should say no. So I'm wondering if you pay any particular attention to the business world, because we seem to see an awful lot of failure of moral courage there, and what more inspiring examples you found of it.
Yeah, he covers Layla Weidler. Is that her name?
Yes, but the point Chris made is a really good one, and it's actually why I deliberately end the book with the story of a financial industry whistleblower named Layla Weidler. The book is really arranged in a way that there's a gradation of cases. So in the first case, which we talked about, the backdrop is Nazi Germany and its refugees begging for help. The wrong is right in front of you, and it's so stark, and we're distant from it now, but we can very easily see it as a black and white thing. In the case of Layla Weidler in the business world, I think one of the reasons these acts are rare there is that it is more abstract and more distant, and people don't necessarily have people, the victims who will suffer as a consequence, right in front of them. And so in Layla's case, she was a broker at a firm that was selling a CD, and she simply started asking questions about what she was selling to her clients. She wanted her boss to tell her, you know, okay, why are the yields so high? Why is it a safe investment? Can I really be sure that my clients won't be taking a risk they don't want to take? Then she got fired all of a sudden. And that set her on a path to having all kinds of suspicions about whether something really wrong was happening with this instrument they were selling. It turns out that the company she worked for was the Stanford Financial Group, which orchestrated the second largest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history, second to the Madoff scheme. Now, Layla had no idea at the time, but she did have these questions, these suspicions. And, you know, as I say in the book, we are very comfortable, I think, with thinking about resistance and saying no in these stark situations that are distant from us. Say Rwanda, what would I have done? Or World War II, boy, what would I have done there? Well, we can take that question home right now to our own lives, to our own daily affairs. I think everybody is fascinated by this question to some extent, because these questions do arise in more prosaic contexts, as Layla's story shows, and sometimes the consequences can be very dire.
Mm-hmm. And how were people changed as a result of of Leila's story, or the story of the second biggest Ponzi scheme, or the Madoff story, or all that's happened on Wall Street. Do people become aware? Are they shocked? Are they more likely, when all of this is exposed, to examine their own behavior?
Well, I would say yes and no to that. I think that you know, one of the themes of the book is definitely that moral courage has this tendency to become contagious. So in case after case that I looked at and also focus on in the stories in the chapters, when one person does something compassionate or courageous or goes against the grain, it becomes so much easier and so much more likely that someone else will also do it. Now, in Leila's case, she was acting quite alone. She was the only broker asking these questions at the time. But it must be said that one of the reasons she asked these questions is that she lived and lives in Houston, Texas. She was a broker at the time of Enron, and that was a stock that a lot of her clients owned. And then, of course, Enron collapsed, and we found out about the accounting fraud, and she was shocked by this. She felt ashamed. She had to explain to her clients, oh, you know, too few of us realized this. And then, of course, she read that there were actually insiders who watched and spoke out. The whistleblowers were there. So in that sense, she was inspired by this example. Of course, as I suggested in that last chapter, too frequently, I think we don't listen enough to the naysayers and the nonconformists, and Leila's case really dramatically shows that. She issued her warnings in 2003, trying to contact the SEC and the media, and it was not until 5.5 years later that the Ponzi scheme was exposed.
5.5 years later. Well, I wonder if you found yourself, after you interviewed these people and read these stories and did this whole examination of nonconformists, were you not discouraged that, you know, 25,000 Jews were turned away, that Leila, it took 5 years for people to believe her story, that we hear the tale of whistleblowers, but we know that so many people are going along with the bad situation? Did you find yourself kind of down?
In some sense, yes, because her warning should have been heeded right away, and Paul Gruninger shouldn't have had his uniform stripped and died in penury and disgrace. At the same time, I think that one of the things that sort of fascinates me about this and made this a really uplifting experience as a reporter is as I said, that here were people who were not perfect in every respect, and yet did something that I think is very human. And in the book, I talk about how, you know, whether it's neuroscience or moral psychology, more and more today we're reading about studies that show that that empathy and compassion and other benevolent impulses are part of what make us human. And we know that those things, those impulses, can get shut off and distorted, and that cruelty is unfortunately too common in the world we have. But I think that we're also filling in the other side of this, and I think that the characters in this book really exemplify and embody that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chris, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And before we carry on with some of the other stories, let's look at some of the scientific experiments that you've written about in this book. What is it that has to happen institutionally or within a bureaucracy that will allow people to commit acts of atrocity that we would think human beings would not be capable of committing?
Well, one of the most famous, in some sense infamous, scientific experiments ever to be conducted on this subject was conducted by Stanley Milgram at Yale University, and he conducted he took a cross section of people in New Haven and set up what he told them was a learning experiment. Every time the learner got a wrong answer, the teacher was supposed to turn up the voltage on an electric generator and give the person a shock. Now, the learner in the experiment was an actor and started started giving wrong answers. And the question was, how many people would continue giving these shocks even as they saw the suffering, the pain, the screaming of this actor, as it turned out? And very much to Milgram's surprise and many people's surprise, two-thirds of the people in that experiment went all the way, kept shocking the learner until he passed out. And the lesson we've drawn from that, which I think is the wrong lesson, is that people are sadistic and they enjoy inflicting cruelty on others. And there's no question that there are, unfortunately, people who do. But if you read, as I did, I went and looked at Milgram's papers and also at the transcripts of the experiments themselves, what you discover is that time and again, the person in, who's told to administer the shock says he does not or she does not want to do this. And they complain and they say, I can't do it, I won't do it, look, this person's suffering, this is horrible. But what ended up happening is that Milgram, the experimenter, at those points, said something very important that relates to the whole theme of the book. He said, don't worry, it's not your responsibility. I'm responsible. You're not responsible. And he called this the agentic state. That is, the person stops feeling they're the agent of the shock. It's the experiment. It's the person above them. And I think that the difficult lesson to draw from this is that we too often, too easily slip into that state and disavow responsibility for acts that, in fact, we are carrying out. And so that's the very difficult lesson from that experiment. But again, it's not right to say that people just didn't care and shocked people. It's rather that they found a good way to comfort themselves that it wasn't them.
Mm. And as people try to become better and better and more empathetic and more compassionate, were there any themes among all the people that you talked with here? And I'm sure that your mind is filled with many, many more people. You selected a certain number of stories for the book. But was there someone in their lives or some religion or something where they learned empathy and compassion? Can we incorporate that in our lives?
I think there are two common threads to all of the characters. The first thing is, I refer to them as true believers. That is, these were not people who went into, whether it was the army in Israel or the Stanford Financial Company or the Swiss police, who wanted to break the law or break ranks. They very much believed in the principles and ideals of the institutions they were serving. And it was precisely because of that, because they believed so much and they were so shocked and taken aback when they saw the moral stain, what they felt was a moral stain on this institution, that they did not and would not go along with it. So I think we have a misperception that it takes a rebellious person, a kind of radical, to do this kind of thing. Very often you find the opposite, a real patriot or a real a person who really invested in the system. The second thing is that they all of these people exercised their moral imaginations in very interesting and important ways. And it really is a book about the moral imagination. I think that we have a lot of literature about how the imagination can be a tool for prejudice or for hatred. We stop imagining that there are people on the other side of the wall or the battle, and we think of them simply as the enemy, and then it becomes a lot easier to do cruel things. Well, that same faculty, the imagination, can also lead us to do the other thing, which is to see a person and say, oh, wait, this actually is, there actually is a child's life at stake here. And I when I say that, I'm referring to, there's a passage in the book where the person who crafted that Swiss law barring refugees actually ran into some children at the refuge at the border of Switzerland and did not have the heart to turn them away. The same person who had written the law couldn't do it in that instant. So the moral imagination can lead us to go against the sort of cruel institutional formulas that are handed down to us.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about true believers, this would be a good time to talk about Avner's situation, because he really believed in and was taught and raised to believe in the Israeli army and in the nation. And what a story this one is. It's just filled with, just filled with all kinds of profundities.
Yeah, well, Avner Wyschnitzer, as you say, could not have grown up more patriotic, and he grew up on a kibbutz, and people familiar with Israel know that for the first few decades of the country's existence, the kibbutzim were really the places, these collective farms, were the places where young men went to the top units of the army and became commanders and became heroes. This is what Avner wanted more than anything. He did have a problem when he was very young, which is that he was this sensitive kid. He felt he was weak. He was too skinny. But he built himself up. He actually became a martial arts black belt. And by the time he was 18, he was chosen for the top unit of the army, Sayeret Matkal. It's really like the Delta Force here. A very, very select group of recruits go into this force. And he served there for 3.5 years, very much believing that he was defending his country and serving in what he thought of as the most moral army in the world. Then, when he was discharged and he was serving as a reservist, he went one day to see a lecture that his sister invited him to. And at the lecture, he saw images of an area in the West Bank where Palestinians were routinely harassed and mistreated by Jewish settlers living there. And Avner hadn't actually served much in the West Bank. He decided he had to go and see what... He didn't really understand what he was seeing, but he was sufficiently disturbed that he decided he had to go there. And he does go there. And for the first time, he actually talks to Palestinians not as a soldier who is their enemy, but as people. And these were farmers. And actually, he grew up on a farm. So it awakened his compassion. He felt, this is wrong. And he also wondered, why, if the army, if my army, is the ruling authority in this territory, why are these settlers allowed to, you know, burn people's fields or chop down their olive trees or do these things that we would never allow people to do in Israel? And he undergoes an awakening to the point that eventually he becomes what in Israel is known as a refusnik. He signs a letter not saying he won't serve in the army. He very much was still willing and ready to serve his country, but he would not serve in the occupied territories.
And what happened to him?
He was a number of things. One, he was discharged from the unit, which he expected. He also had his nerves tested in a way he had never had them tested before. And listeners should keep in mind, this is a guy who, as one would imagine, serving in a unit like that, no shortage of moral courage. You know, we didn't go into details, but I know that he served for 3.5 years in the army, often on dangerous missions. Mm. And yet he told me that the courage it took to refuse to tell his commander, I will not serve in the occupied territories, that this was 10 times harder for him. Mm-hmm. And he likened it to jumping out of an airplane, which, again, he'd been trained to do. And he said, you know, we get trained for that, and we think we're ready. And the first time you do it, you're let out, and you have no idea what's going on. You're terrified because you're alone. And that aloneness is what he felt, which was so intense that here he was thinking, I can't do this, and yet I'm going against my society and everything I've been raised on, you know, this idea of service and so forth.
We welcome more phone calls if you would like to join the conversation. It may be you're just absorbed in the stories, but I'm sure that some of you have in your minds, or maybe you, but you're so shy you don't want to talk about your own acts of moral courage. But as we examine this, looking at your conscience, looking at developing empathy, why is it that ordinary people can do these extraordinary things, even though it's really against the tide? and you may know of such people or instances in history that you would like to highlight this hour as well. Our guest is Isle Press. He's the author of Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Isle is an author and journalist. His work has appeared in the New York Review of Books, the New York Times Magazine, The Nation, Raritan, a quarterly review, and many other publications. He's also the author of Absolute Convictions and a past recipient of the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism. Feel free to join us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655, and the email is talk@wpr.org. We'll go to phone calls in just a moment. It's in the book, so I assume you don't mind talking a little bit about your own life, Isle, but you write that after you were listening to Avner tell his story, you felt like you were hearing an account of your imaginary counterlife, the alternative path that you might have followed had it not been for some twists in your family history. What were those?
Yes. Thank you for reminding me of that. But no, it is a very important aspect of the book that it definitely did. I hope that readers, in a sense, put themselves in the shoes of the different characters, think about how they might negotiate the dilemmas that they face. And for me, with Avner in particular, that was quite easy to do because I, like him, was born in Israel. He was born in 1976. I was born in 1970. The year I grew up, unlike him, I grew up in the United States. My family left when I was very young. In 1988, when I turned 18, I would have been drafted to serve in the Israeli army had my family stayed. And 1988 happened to be the year, just 87 was technically the start, but the year that the first Palestinian intifada really erupted. And this was a massive popular resistance to the occupation. And it was all over the newspapers. It was on the nightly news here. And inevitably, I began to think, not least because I had relatives and friends who were serving in the army, what would I do if I were there? And I also read about how in Israel for the first time, you had soldiers who said, I will not serve in enforcing this occupation. I don't believe that that holding this land and ruling over it militarily is right. And so that was really the first time I started to mull this dilemma. Now, I have to say that much like the character I describe, Avner Wishnitzer, I didn't know this phrase at the time, but in a sense, if I thought at the time of a person who did refuse, I think I would have been prone to worrying that people would see me as a beautiful soul. And when I say that, some people might think, well, isn't that a good thing? In Israel, the term beautiful souls, yafei nefesh, carries the connotation of being a bleeding heart, of being too soft, too pure, naive, not, having the toughness to go and serve. And in the chapter in the book on Avner Wishnitzer, he actually talks about this very directly. He says at one point that when he was really starting to feel, my gosh, how can I serve at a checkpoint in these other places, in these situations where I feel a wrong is being done, even as he's going through that, he says to himself, I'm not some yafei nefesh. I'm really just a patriot. I'm the same guy I was, and yet I'm feeling these things. And so the title of the book carries a little more ambiguity than people unfamiliar with the phrase might think. It gets at, I think, what is true, which is that when we take a stand, when we cling to our principles, there are always fears and risks involved, and the fear, the greatest fear maybe, is the perception from others that we are being irresponsible, that we are being naive, that we are bleeding hearts, whatever it is. And I think that discourages a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Ken. Hi, Ken.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A little reluctant here to call, but I think most people think they would be the one to stand up against the odds and do the right thing, and yet I think kind of history or reality shows us that most people wouldn't. And I guess my experience with this, well, I was drafted during the Vietnam era, and there was a time when we were training with pugil sticks, they call them, but it's basically kind of like jousting, and you've got like boxing gloves on the end. But there was a young, just a real weak recruit that had failed a couple times in his efforts to get through basic training, and it seemed like the training people had kind of turned on him, and they threw him in a circle of other recruits and just goaded recruits to just kind of beat this kid up.
Oh.
And I guess I wish I was done more. I mean, I refused to participate and verbally indicated that, but I'm kind of haunted that I didn't step into the ring and defend him, I guess. But, I mean, you just see this. And so I guess I hope that I would do a little better in the future as far as stepping out. But, yeah, I guess I had another situation in Vietnam, but I've said enough here, so I guess take your comments.
No, I'm glad you said important things. Thank you, Ken, for the call.
Yeah, thank you. That took a lot of courage to talk about, and I think that I would say that it's probably a reflection of the fact that the caller is a courageous person, and maybe more courageous than he gives himself credit for. In fact, I quote in the book Robert J. Lifton, the psychologist and historian, who interviewed a soldier who was at My Lai, and who did not fire at My Lai, this massacre that took place in a village in the war. But far from being proud of the fact that he did not fire, he was ashamed. And he was ashamed because he didn't actively resist. He didn't take the next step. And what Lifton said is, you know, the very sensitivity in this person and the courage it took not to fire is what made him feel I should have done even more than I did. In terms of, I don't disagree with what the caller said about most people actually would go along. My book is not written to counter that claim. There's just too much evidence. And indeed, when we say nonconformists, we're talking about the exceptions. These may be ordinary people. That doesn't mean they're unexceptional. They certainly are exceptional. But there are things that I came across that really were striking in terms of sort of illuminating what how much people would be willing to resist if they weren't so afraid, if there wasn't so much pressure or conformity, and maybe in a sense, if they could get away with it. And one of the most striking studies I found was the study of the firing rate in World War II among U.S. soldiers. And this is a famous study, and some people have disputed the figures, although other people have really confirmed them, and indeed there are whole books about that about this. But essentially, there was a researcher, Marshall, who was sent to see what the firing rates were of soldiers on the front lines, and he discovered that no more than 15% of the soldiers facing the enemy actually aimed and fired.
Really?
Many deliberately misfired. They aimed above the target.
Oh.
They didn't fire at all. And Marshall, who was a very, Marshall saw this as a problem because he wanted them to fire more. He felt the Army needed them to fire more. But he said, you know, in the average soldier, face-to-face with a person in such a situation, there is a conscientious objector. And so that was a really striking thing to find and to come across. And I think that in other places in the book, I felt like, again, that contagion effect suggested that once the terrible fear of being all alone, of doing this when no one else is doing it, is a little bit overcome, you see more people step forward. And so that's, I think, a somewhat hopeful thing to think about.
Thank you, Ken, so much for your call. Ed in Oshkosh, hi.
Hello. Excellent topic, very moving. A number of years ago, while visiting London with my family, I exited Westminster Abbey on the west side and noticed 10 snow-white statues that were much different than the rest of the architecture. And asking a guide, I was told that these were 20th century martyrs that the British people have chose to recognize. All of them fit the mold of what your speaker is talking about. Just to give you one, it was Maximilian Kolbe, who was the Roman Catholic priest that took the place of a father who was to be killed by the Nazis in Auschwitz.
Mm.
Oscar Romero, Martin Luther King, Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Mm.
I have used this in a classroom in a public school and in a religious setting in Christian education. And it's just a marvelous reference.
It certainly is.
Thank you for sharing that.
Okay.
Thanks so much for the call. I remember when I was in school that certainly people, and you reference him in the book, Thoreau was somebody who we contemplated and was kind of a hero of ours back in those days of civil disobedience and that whole concept. I'm wondering if what you're writing about and what Ed just described and what I remember from being in high school is on the minds of people today. Is it something that we read about, that we contemplate in our schools?
I certainly hope so, and it's encouraging to get a call from a teacher.
Yes.
Think that to touch again on the sort of motive for writing the book. I feel like we have an enormous literature, and rightly so, about conformity and evil and people being thrust into these dilemmas, these morally compromising situations, and the worst of them comes out, or the weakest in them comes out. But it is also the case that even in situations of seemingly total conformity, there are always a few people who don't go along. And I think we need to know those stories, in part because if we only hear the stories of the conformists, we have no way to judge, much less hold accountable, the people who say, look, I was only doing what anyone in my shoes would have done. And indeed, I opened the book with such a claim that was made by some German soldiers who participated in a massacre. Mm-hmm. And the historian who narrates that, who has written about that massacre, says, well, actually, we can't accept that. And we can't accept that because we know that in this battalion, some of the soldiers didn't shoot and others stopped shooting. So we have to, I think, give some space, even if it's not the norm. We have to give some space to these counter stories. And we have to remember that human beings are capable of choice and that the choices are in front of all of us.
Mm-hmm. We have time for one more call. We're running out of time. Debbie in Baraboo, hi.
Hi. Just a quick question for your guest. I'm wondering if you have insights on how we can develop this kind of empathy and moral courage in our children today.
Hmm. The teacher who just called probably knows more about this than I do. I think that telling the stories, knowing these stories, and maybe encouraging and inculcating a belief that that the crowd isn't, that going along with the crowd is not always the most important thing. I think most parents do tell their children that, but that there is this voice that people hear when what they've been raised to think of as right is being violated, and something goes on. And I don't think that's just a personal voice. I think that has to do with the values they learn in their family, in their community, in their culture. Acting on it is difficult, and I think that children should be encouraged to know that taking that act and defying the crowd is okay, is right sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was a great hour. It was great to speak with you, and it's good for us to think about these issues. What could be more important, right?
Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you to the callers.
Mm-hmm. Our pleasure. Our guest this hour, Eyal Press. It's EYAL Press. The book is Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Just been published. And it sure makes you think. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee. We want to tell you about an event that's coming up in April. It's going to be a party for WHAD Dinner for listeners. Larry Mueller with gardening expert Melinda Myers will be creating a garden talk radio program, a mock program. It's going to be at a beautiful location here in Milwaukee. If you haven't been to the Mitchell Park Domes, you can go to the desert, you can go to the jungle, you can see flowers. It's really a nice place. The doors open at 6, dinner at 7, program at 7:30. And it's a thank you to all of our loyal listeners and a chance for you to interact with radio personalities, local staff members, and fans of Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information or to reserve tickets, go to WPR.org/Milwaukee. That's WPR.org/Milwaukee. I'll be with you again Monday morning at 9 for all things political. Thanks.